I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Anand Giridharadas gave a TED Talk back in 2015 called A Tale of Two Americas that ended with him calling out those who were feeling above it all, too virtuous to be part of the problem.
And don't console yourself that you are the 99%. If you live near a Whole Foods, if no one in your family serves in the military, if you're paid by the year, not the hour, if most people you know finished college, if no one you know uses meth, if you married once and remain married, if you're not one of 65 million Americans with a criminal record, if any or all of these things describe you, then accept the possibility that actually you may not know what's going on, and you may be part of the problem.
Giridharadas' new book, Winners Take All, expands on those ideas and his experiences being a fellow at the Aspen Institute by challenging the comfort of the elites who believe in doing well by doing good. He says they're playing a double game. He writes about this belief system, quote, by refusing to risk its way of life, by rejecting the idea that the powerful might have to sacrifice for the common good, it clings to a set of social arrangements that allow it to monopolize progress and give symbolic scraps to the forsaken, many of whom wouldn't need the scraps if the society were working right. Well, it's clear that a small, even tiny minority has reaped the benefits of the country's economic and political system. Most Americans have not. Anand Giridharadas is a writer. He's also a political analyst for MSNBC. He teaches journalism at New York University, was a foreign correspondent and columnist for The New York Times, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Anand, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here with you.
So who are these elites who, you write, prefer to do virtuous side projects instead of doing their day jobs more honorably?
Since the late 1970s, a relatively small group of Americans has harvested most of the rainwater of progress. There's been no shortage of innovation and advancement and new stuff since the 70s. The internet, the genetics revolution, medicines, you know, the rise of India and China and all the opportunities and also, of course, problems that that created. But when the rain of the future fell on us as a society over the last few decades, a small number of Americans, you can call it the 1%, in some ways it's the 10%, in some ways it's the 0.0001%. There's different places to put the dot. But a small number of Americans managed to corner the benefits of those changes. And at the heart of the argument of winners take all is that it didn't happen naturally. That was engineered. They designed the society through laws they pushed for, through tax policies they pushed for, through a system of how we regulate labor that they pushed for, to produce that outcome where workers, middle-class people, regular people didn't really reap that much from all of this churn, and they did. And what I became interested in for this book is the fact that even as they were the overlords of this increasingly unfair winners-take-all economy,
reaping the benefits,
they were also at that very same time engaging in a historic amount of generosity. I mean, today, more money is given away in the world and certainly in the U.S. than has ever been given away in history. I think Americans gave away $410 billion last year, which is starting to approach the level of federal non-military discretionary spending. You know, you have people signing the Giving Pledge, and 184 billionaires have signed, you know, give all their money away, half their money away. Every young person who graduates from an elite college seemingly wants to go change the world and intern in Africa or start a social enterprise. And I just became interested in these two parallel facts. How is it that we live in an age where elites are so generous and so predatory?
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things that you just said there. And I'm thinking, as a book like this would get us thinking about the Carnegies, the Mellons, the Rockefellers. In many ways, these were called the robber barons of the Gilded Age. How are today's philanthropists different from those philanthropists?
In many ways, it's similar. And I think in many ways, we are now, you know, there are cycles in history. And I think in many ways, we are at a place that is very similar to where we were 100 years ago. In a few ways. Number one, you have essentially private innovations and discoveries that change a lot of people's lives very quickly. In that case, it was the Industrial Revolution and factories and all these things. In our case, it's the information economy and globalization and the connection to all these other countries. But you have these kind of big changes where, in a way, what's happening in business, what's happening in society, what's happening in terms of the economy outstrips our society's ability to understand it, make sense of it, regulate it, order it. So that's kind of normal. And what happened 100 years ago is you had all these big fortunes that were invented.
Right.
And you had these very rich guys saying, well, we'll take care of these problems. We have to be ruthless.
We'll build libraries. We'll support universities.
Well, before the libraries, first we will be ruthless in our business because that's what's required. And Andrew Carnegie really laid the framework for that in his famous tract, The Gospel of Wealth. You got to let me be ruthless. You got to let me, you know, essentially not pay workers any more than I have to. Got to bust unions. If you got to bust unions, you do what you got to do to make money. And then, when you have that money, you give to the public good. You build a library. So, extreme taking followed by extreme giving. And I think we are right back where we started. In between that 100 years, we actually went a different way. We built systems and institutions, and from the FDA to the Rural Electrification Act to doing civil rights and empowering women, and we did a bunch of things that were not rich people throwing down scraps. We actually learned to make change in the 20th century through our common institutions and by building the interstate highway system and by having movements to actually change law and change policy. But we're kind of going back to where we were 100 years ago, where you have this extraordinary private growth. You have many, many people who have failed to benefit from it. And you have these rich people who have spent the last 30, 40 years actually lobbying against government, telling us government is the problem, working around government, weakening government, and then having weakened it, having now sitting on top of a society where there are actually proliferating social problems because the government can't do as much as it used to do, they now step in and say, oh, looky here. You got a government that can't really solve your problems, not mentioning that they're the ones, you know, who made that happen. Let me step in and solve it. Let me, Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk, let me solve the society's problem.
In fact, you write about David Rubenstein, co-founder of the Carlyle Group. There was a earthquake that damaged the Washington Monument and needed repair. He stepped in. He spent something like $15 million to repair it. But then you go on to say that, well, how nice of him, how generous of him. He actually benefits from this carried interest loophole, very wonky kind of thing, but he has benefited greatly because of our tax system. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, let's unpack that for a minute because it's such a good example. David Rubenstein has gotten a lot of credit as this what's so-called patriotic philanthropy, that as he describes it. Right. You know, he's a patriotic philanthropist. So he paid half of that $15 million tab for the earthquake-damaged Washington Monument. He's bought documents for the National Archives, bought flags, and I don't know what, you know. And he's kind of presented, if you go on YouTube, there's not a lot of videos about his business activity, but there's a lot of videos about all his patriotic things. The guy gives lectures on the 13th Amendment as though he were someone who knows a lot about the 13th Amendment, et cetera, et cetera. So his reputation that you might see is a sage, a scholar, a man whose heart bleeds for America. Well, the reality is David Rubenstein's a big part of why the government doesn't have enough money, thus requiring David Rubenstein to step in, because not only does he benefit from, he was, and his firm and his industry were some of the people who fought tooth and nail to allow investors to basically have a separate and preferred tax regime where they get taxed less than regular people. And, you know, you heard that Warren Buffett line about, you know, he shouldn't pay less taxes than his secretary. Well,
exactly.
That's the loophole that we're talking about. So it's wonky, but it's also very simple. Like, rich investors have rigged the society to pay less taxes, you know, than others as a rate. And
are there exceptions, though? Are there people or even organizations or philanthropic organizations that you see are bucking the trend that you're describing?
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the things I argue in the book is that a lot of the rich people who claim to be changing the world in our time are in fact fundamentally serving to keep the world the same. However, there are ways, and I think it's very important for your listeners to know this, it's not all lost. There are absolutely ways to make change that are real, even as a private actor, even as a philanthropist. And so, you know, And there's a whole spectrum. But, you know, if you look at something like the Ford Foundation, I read about Darren Walker in the book, who's the president of the Ford Foundation. They have a focus on kind of social justice issues. And Darren has moved them more and more towards root cause issues. Let's deal with inequality. Let's not just palliate, but let's try to understand why, you know, there is inequality. And let's try to program towards that. They're in the relatively early days of that experiment, but that's one example. You also have, you know, one of my favorite examples of this is an unsung group of people out in California, some philanthropists who fund work to improve the census count. Okay? This is something that doesn't get a lot of attention. No. It's not as sexy as like Mark Zuckerberg going to Newark where he'd never gone before and trying to like transform its schools for $100 million. But listen to what these census folks do. If you take the Zuckerberg example, he's kind of Columbusing his way into Newark and trying to like redesign its schools. Well,
and it didn't work out so well.
And it obviously didn't work, but, you know, in the finest Columbusing tradition. If you think about what the census people do, they are – so it's the government that does the census count. However, the government has a procedure for private folks to suggest addresses that the government may not be aware of. Or if someone's like living on a roof – of a house, the government may not know that someone's on a roof of the house. So, but you can, there's a database that you can kind of add, and the government will check if those are correct, and you can make the census more accurate, and you can essentially make the census count more undercounted and underprivileged people. So, there's a group of, you know, there's this couple called the Kissims in California, but there's others who have invested privately in that process to find undiscovered people. And New York City actually has its own public version of trying to do that to help the federal census, but in California it's philanthropists. And they send people around, literally looking on the roofs of houses, looking in alleyways, because people live in a lot of places that government records don't suggest, trying to add those to the list and get those people counted. The reason I think that's an interesting and different form of change is a couple things. One, if those philanthropists succeed, if they add more people to the census, it will actually come at their expense in the sense that those are generally poorer people who will benefit from government spending and government help, which
if they vote a certain way.
Well, right. But well, regardless of how they vote, they're going to be eligible for all kinds of things. And those people who are donating that money, that's in a way not in their interest to like discover people who are going to in a way cost more resources. So they're kind of willing to threaten their own privilege. But secondly, and this is important, it's a form of a giving still allows government to play a central role in solving a public problem. It's helping the government being better instead of working around the government.
Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation with our guest Anand Giridharadas. And his new book is called Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. We want you to join our conversation. Here's that phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Anand Giridharadas about his new book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. I want to pick up on a couple of things. And there is a feeling, rightly or wrongly, that, you know, government is incapable of solving our very important, intractable, and deep problems. And there's probably some evidence to that effect. I mean, it seems certainly when you look in Washington, you see a lot of dysfunction, a lot of infighting, naming of post offices, undoing a lot of regulations and things like that. But not dealing with infrastructure or our immigration problems. And I was thinking also about maternity or paternity or family leave when a child is born. And the government, certainly compared to our European counterparts, is very ungenerous. And yet companies have stepped in. Apparently Netflix gives 52 weeks of paid maternity leave for their employees. So in many ways, perhaps business or even philanthropy is doing the job the government won't do, maybe for their own selfish reasons. But how do you see that sort of balance between these two forces?
It's a great question. I mean, there's no question that a lot of private actors end up stepping into the void. But part of what I want people to understand and part of what motivated me to write Winners Take All is the idea of how that happened. Why did government become incapable of doing some of these things? It's not a natural occurrence like, a cloud in the sky. So part of what happened is companies and wealthy people spent the last 30 or 40 years pushing for government to do less, convincing us that government was the problem, that it was an enemy, othering government at every turn. This idea that government is this, horrible thing that's coming to get your stuff is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. That was an engineered idea spread by wealthy people. I mean, you can go back to the 70s. Lewis Powell, before he went on the Supreme Court, he was worked as a lawyer for business interests and wrote this famous memo in which he said, communism is spreading, and if we business interests don't get together and kind of spread this idea, we're going to get snowed. And so there was a project to discredit government and credit the private sector with the only people able to solve things. And so then when private people step in and say, oh, man, what a shame. The government can't do stuff. Let us step in. It's a little bit like, we had a hen house, and the hen house actually had a guard. Hmm. And then a fox came and bit the guard in the leg, and the guard's stumbling away bleeding. And now the fox is like, oh, what a shame. There's no guard here. These poor hens. Allow me to guard this hen house, right? And so, yeah, it's great that companies do this, but those same companies that have those generous plans often lobby in Washington to prevent the government from giving that to everybody. Hmm. The issue is, why are we in this society not able to solve these problems for all of us at the root? Why do we allow it to be solved by rich people's whims when and if they choose for us to have maternity leave, to actually have a good education system? Why are we dependent on how they wake up feeling in the morning?
Does that explain the appeal of candidate, now President Donald Trump, who said, only I can fix it? Which is, he lives certainly in that business world. Not much philanthropy from what we've been able to figure out. But here he is, obviously, President of the United States, and believing and saying, and I think a lot of his followers believing, only I can do it. Was that an appealing message then?
I think one of the uncomfortable truths, and I tried to, as I went into this world for this book and spent time on cruise ships full of entrepreneurs and limousines with foundation presidents, and I really burrowed into this world to do the reporting. One of the things I found that was very dark was that Donald Trump is not the beginning of the billionaire conning of America. He is the culmination of the billionaire conning of America. And a lot of the things that Donald Trump actually says, a lot of his quote-unquote intellectual moves, and I use that in very heavy quotation marks, actually originated among this philanthrocapitalist set. So one is the idea that you articulate, I alone can fix it. Donald Trump is not the first person to say that. That is this deeply philanthrocapitalist billionaire savior idea of like, we are these specially capable people. Because we built an internet company, we should be able to decide what newer schools are like. Because we built the social network, we can end all the diseases. These people have no respect for the institutions of our society and just think they can do everything by themselves. He got that language from a lot of other people. When Donald Trump essentially lives this life where he can claim to be fighting for the common man while also enriching himself mm-hmm. at every possible turn, mm-hmm. again, that didn't start with him. That is the win-win. That is the deep idea of the win-win, which is what all these billionaire saviors have been espousing, which is basically, I can do well and do good. I can make a killing for myself, and I can make a difference at the same time, no sacrifice.
But are you also saying that either liberals / Democrats or people that might oppose that idea did not do enough to address the social economic inequality, the fact that so many millions of people in this country feel, and it's more than just feelings, are not reaping the benefits of the
Correct.
Society we've created.
Look, the primary person responsible for what I regard as the tragedy of Donald Trump is Donald Trump. The people next most responsible are the people who voted for him and the people on the right who pushed him. However, one of the important arguments of the book, and it's an uncomfortable argument and uncomfortable for people to hear, is that a lot of well-meaning people on the left, wealthy people, people at these powerful companies, were part of enabling Trump's rise. And I deeply believe that. And I think they did so in two ways. One, in the ways I indicated, by supplying him a kind of intellectual framework of the win-win and I alone can fix it, et cetera, which he very much borrowed. But the other way that some of those liberals enabled him is by promoting so many non-solutions, fake change solutions to urgent public problems, by putting so many Band-Aids on the various cancers that our society had, they created space for a strongman demagogue to come in and say, problems are not being addressed. We need transformational change. I will do it. If they had actually been fixing the issues of trade that people were experiencing, the issues and anxieties around immigration that people were experiencing, the issues around globalization and technology and automation that people were experiencing, if those had been their focus, I don't know that there would be oxygen for him. And I want to say one more thing about this government idea. We don't only have one government. You can't blame like the Congress for every. We have every state has a government. They're not all dysfunctional, right? Every city has a government. They're not all dysfunctional. There's city councils. There's a lot of government in this country, and we have neglected it. And those are all places where we can make policy. People can make actually a real difference in people's lives. There are so many workers in America, just take one issue, who have volatile hours, whose hours are changed week to week. And if you just stand outside any restaurant, any business, you hear workers on a cigarette break, they're always talking about their hours because they are jerked around in this country. That is an issue that's not about Congress necessarily. Congress could fix that, but any city in America can fix that. Any state in America can fix that. We are not making change, real change, in various places, and we can't just absolve ourselves that, you know, Congress is a write-off.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Aman Girdadas, and we're talking about his new book, Winners Take All, subtitled The Elite Charade of Change. I'll do that correctly. The elite charade of changing the world. And you can join us again, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do you think that then explains some of these surprising victories by these self-described democratic socialists that you see running, frankly, as Democrats or running on the left side and surprising, I think, a lot of the pundits by beating long-term incumbents and perhaps possibly changing the country?
I mean, you have a lot of these, whether it's a Democratic socialist, whether it's someone like Andrew Gillum in Florida running for governor who's not a Democratic socialist but is running on a very strongly, unapologetically progressive platform. You have a lot of Democrats today espousing the radical notion that people shouldn't live in misery in the United States of America. Apparently, that's a radical idea in our country today. You have a lot of people saying essentially that we shouldn't live in fear of our like a deportation strike force. You shouldn't live, not having $400 to spend on an emergency as like half of Americans are unable to do. You shouldn't live in a situation where your employer has all the power and you have none and therefore you get, yanked around. You shouldn't live where if your kid gets sick, that's kind of the end of the road financially for your family. You shouldn't live in a world in which your education is based on, how rich you are. If those are radical ideas, I think we need to adjust our definition of radical. And by the way, radical actually just means at the root, radish.
Oh, radish. That's
and
right. Forgot about
perhaps,
that.
Perhaps, these folks should actually embrace the notion of being radical because I actually don't think they are radical in the sense of being crazy or wild or, out of the mainstream. I think they're radical in the sense of they're actually trying to solve problems at the root.
Why are they called radical? Because extremists run that we're not the democracy or the republic that we think we are, that the extremists are really the ones in charge?
I will tell you, I know many personal stories and there's been a lot of reporting. When people decide to run, like we have to have a real conversation with the Democratic Party at some point, right? Because I know for a fact that when a lot of people who are smart and talented and important figures in their community have decided to run for Congress, even in this cycle, the first post-Trump cycle, they get a call from the DNC and the first thing is always like, how much money can you raise?
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Now, that to me is telling you something that is deeply, deeply, fundamentally wrong. It's fine, frankly, of the Republican Party, because the Republican Party is actually the party of business interests and minimal government. But for the party that is supposed to be the party of the common man and workers to essentially be a money-captured party as well is very, very difficult. And I think one of the reasons we are in the situation we're in is that there's a real, I think, identity conflict in the Democrats. At one level, there's a feeling you have to raise this money to be able to compete.
Play the game, right?
On the other hand, I think that leads you to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in leadership positions, which are basically people who are very good at raising money and playing that game. I don't
Pulling
the levers. I don't think if you walk down the street and you asked Americans, look, this is a party that represents half the country, who are the two most inspiring people to run this party in Congress? I don't think the algorithm would produce them.
Right. Who would it produce?
I think many of these people who are flirting with presidential runs are exciting, and there's a variety of them. I think people like just in the news recently, this Andrew Gillum figure.
From
I think
Tallahassee, right?
It's just a very fascinating figure. Has very progressive views, but won clearly by having a message that reached out to people who may not even have his views, but he's just an appealing figure. I think, you have people like Kamala Harris who are very exciting. I think Mitch Landrieu is a very fascinating figure.
From New Orleans.
Former mayor of New Orleans, who, as a white man who's spoken more eloquently about race and the need for reconciliation than many people.
Including Barack Obama?
Well, I mean, Barack Obama in this very city has given the greatest speech on race perhaps in modern times. But certainly, as a white American, Mitch Landrieu has taken that issue on with a fearlessness and a realness that is extraordinary, and I think is an extraordinary contribution. I think there's a lot of exciting things out there. I just hope that there's a real reckoning about the role of money in the party, because, at the end of the day, the Democratic Party can't just be the party of money that is tolerant, and the Republican Party be the party of money that is intolerant. I think one of them should not be the party of money.
Craig writes, the guest is avoiding a lot of facts to make his point. The U.S. government was discredited by Vietnam, Watergate, and some unfulfilled promises of the Great Society, not business manipulating the people in the 1970s. The crisis in confidence in government is a result of the feeling of being left behind and increasing government regulation in everyday life. This is not an invention of business. It is a reality of today's society. Interesting point from Craig.
Yeah, it's nice to have the Koch brothers weighing in over there.
I don't think that's fair.
I think that's an interesting point of view, and I think he's absolutely right that there were many things that allowed government to lose trust. I mean, the numbers have gone from, I think 70-something percent of people generally having trust in government to the number being in the teens today. And it was absolutely the war, and it was Watergate, and it was all kinds of things. But the point I'm making is narrower, which is there's just a history that's very well documented of business interests, chamber of commerce type interests getting together, organizing, realizing that in the 70s there was a political threat on the horizon of the government stepping in and pushing an agenda that would have been perhaps good for society but bad for business, and very aggressively getting out in front of that and creating an anti-tax movement. And you have Grover Norquist, and all this history is very well documented. These are not natural occurrences. There was a plan, and the plan was to discredit government, to cut taxes, because if you actually just convince people to cut taxes, even though they may actually benefit from government spending, then the government wouldn't have those resources, so you didn't even have the argument about spending. There's a whole documented history of what was done to promote those interests. And yeah, Craig's absolutely right that there were a lot of other things that have contributed to that mistrust. And yeah, there is overregulation of certain things. But, I don't think we live in a society in which people are more harmed by overregulation than underregulation. I will say that.
Christopher emails, who in the midterm elections are speaking as if they understand your thesis? What is the language to watch for in the 2020 election?
I think, interestingly, folks like, Cynthia Nixon.
In New York,
running for governor. You have Zephyr Teachout also in New York in my backyard running for attorney general. You have the Ocasios. But it doesn't only have to be people that are on the, you know, further left. I mean, I think there are people in different ways trying to solve the following problem, which is how can the Democratic Party not lock itself into being a party of no more than 50% of this country? How can it actually be a party of 70 or 75%, at least address itself to a broad array of people? And the challenge there, and I think why you're seeing a lot of different people try a lot of different things, the challenge is essentially how do you hold together two very different audiences in that 70% scenario, one of which is essentially the rising new America that's the majority minority country and women and people of color and the kind of coalition of more marginalized and vulnerable people. How do you hold that group together and absolutely stand by them and for their interests? And at the same time, as some Democrats are trying to figure out, also win back enough of those Trump people to secure the rights of those people you're trying to protect. Because I certainly believe that if there's none of that reaching out, it's not a very durable security. You may win this election and you're going to lose the next one. I think the more durable security for this rising new America that is pluralist and open is to actually connect with some of those Trump people on some of those cross-cutting economic issues that would actually build a coalition of people who feel themselves on the wrong side of power.
And that's Anand Giridharadas, our guest on Radio Times today. We got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, and I am talking with our guest, Anand Giridharadas, and we are talking about his new book, which is about many things, as you can probably tell, but it also is a critique of what might be described as do-gooder billionaires or millionaires trying to make the world a better place. He argues that these global elites and their philanthropic work actually just preserves the status quo in many ways and benefits the current social order, including the status of the wealthy and the well-connected. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. I played that clip from your TED Talk of a couple of years ago, but you also admit and say that in many ways you're not a billionaire, but you're talking also about yourself. Also, and I will say that I also recognize some of myself in what you're writing as well.
Yeah,
again, not a millionaire or a billionaire, but nonetheless have reaped incredible benefits from this country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I say in the acknowledgments of the book, the best way to know about a problem is to be part of it.
Right.
And this sphere of pseudo change making created by the very rich and powerful and companies in recent years is a sphere that has sucked many people in, including me. I mean, it's if you're a writer and thinker, and you know, you may go to the TED conference or some other conference, and you may
or Davos or Aspen,
all those things. And I was part of this Aspen Fellowship, and it was actually through being in that world and kind of feeling a discomfort, and then starting to think more deeply about where that discomfort was coming from, that I started to realize that when rich and powerful people get together and talk about changing the world, often what they're doing is organizing the world in ways that don't require their world to change.
You do include a blurb, or Bill Gates has a blurb on the back of your book. Of course, we know about his wealth and his philanthropy.
I was surprised. I mean, I try a lot of things on a lark, and I thought there was a good chance it would come back.
No, thank you.
And I thought, you know, even if he'd give no thank you, maybe I'll just take that and put that on the back of the book. He came back with it. And I think part of what's interesting is, you know, I think there are legitimate questions around how much power over public life should any individual have, whether it's Bill Gates or anybody else. But I do also think there are a lot of people, and Bill Gates is giving away real money and is interested in system change, even if, you know, he ends up going about it in ways that raise these questions about private power. But I think there's this other species of thing, which is like the investment bank that, you know, rapes and pillages a community and then gives $500,000 to a charter school in that same community. And it's, you know, just that's just like a scam. And so I think what's interesting is that within that world, there's a big difference between what a Gates is doing and what an investment bank is doing when it rapes and pillages and then, you know, throws a few scraps. And I think you're starting to see that argument kind of come out in the open, because a lot of the actual, you know, ambitious givers, I think, don't necessarily want to be associated with with people who are essentially using giving as a kind of papal indulgence or reputation wash.
This book is has interviews. You spend a fair amount of time talking to a number of people, including former President Bill Clinton. And, of course, the Clinton Global Initiative has been under the spotlight for years and a real glare when Hillary Clinton was running for president. What do you make of what the Clintons do or what this their foundation does?
One of the things that I wanted to do in writing Winners Take All was to avoid sitting on the sidelines and just judging people, as much as I enjoy doing that as a private sport. I wanted to write a book that actually engaged deeply with the people that I was writing about. And so at first I actually went to this final Clinton Global Initiative, spent 2 days there, reported on it, described it. But then I realized that was not enough. I needed to engage with the man behind it. So I ended up getting 90 minutes with President Clinton. And we sat, it was about 6 months after Hillary lost the election. And we sat in his office in Midtown Manhattan. And we had this, you know, really interesting conversation, because I think Bill Clinton embodies, maybe better than anybody who is alive, the shift from a view that you solve problems collectively at the root through democratic life, through movements, through law, to the present prevailing view that you kind of solve, you know, problems through these plutocratic partnerships. In 1964, he was a real big movement guy and a Lyndon Johnson guy. And today, you know, he does things like the Goldman Sachs and McDonald's will collaborate on a project to, you know, help kids, you know, exercise more. But of course, no one will think about like regulating their food. So we had this conversation about how he kind of made that evolution. And one of the very striking moments was we talked about the issue of childhood obesity that he'd worked on.
Right.
And I said, you know, isn't that an issue where the case for government is just really clear? Like, it's kids. They have no ability to vote. They have no ability to keep these vending machines out of their school. They have no power. And you got these really well-connected, wealthy companies coming in, using their clout to get those vending machines in those schools and essentially abuse their power over kids, and kids are becoming obese and having lifelong health complications. Like, that seems as clear-cut a case to me as any for the government just stepping in. Why didn't you, as a former president, lead a movement, push the government to step in and help those kids? Well, he says, no, you got to, if you want to take on an issue like that, you have to innovate, because the company still needs to have a business model.
Meaning just, they have to make money?
They still have to make money.
Which they do, don't they? Or do they?
Is that our problem?
No, I mean, I'm not saying it's our problem.
It struck me as really fascinating that he thought that was his problem.
Right, I got it.
Let the company, I mean, the company is making kids fat and giving them lifelong health issues. Who cares if they have a business? That's your issue. You're harming children. Let's do us and let them do them. Why? It struck me as encapsulating something about our age, that even someone who had run the most powerful machinery of state in the history of civilization essentially felt like, as he put it, it's always better if you can do something through the private sector.
Oh, fascinating. We got some emails, but my screen here is scrolling back and forth. So let me ask you about the Sacklers, who you write about in this book. They are the creators, if we can say, of the name escapes me. Opioid.
OxyContin.
OxyContin. Thank you very much. And obviously, and I remember, I've been doing the show long enough, doing shows years ago, before the days of OxyContin, to be perfectly honest with you. And doctors and nurses were saying, we need pain medication. We under-treat people who are in pain. OxyContin arrives, and of course now we've got this terrible opioid epidemic. And in many ways, Philadelphia is a ground zero, if not the ground zero. How do you make sense then of the Sacklers?
So, you know, the Sacklers have this company called Purdue Pharma, which invented this drug. And the reason the drug was revolutionary was it was a very, very strong dose of oxycodone, the active ingredient, this painkiller. But they invented a slow-release formula. So you swallowed the pill, and then in your stomach it would, you know, slowly dissolve over hours and hours, you know, thus giving you strong pain relief but lasting relief over a long period. You know, what unfortunately people figured out pretty quickly is that you can chew the tablet in your mouth and suddenly that 12 hours or whatever it is of relief can, you know, can be had as a essentially a, you know, shock therapy of feel good. Or you can, you know, snort it or, you know, but ingest it quickly in a way that it wasn't intended. Now, this is kind of an obvious thing. I mean, that some people are going to chew this and figure this out, right? And what Purdue Pharma did was to basically at every turn insist that, nope, this was actually a revolutionary drug and how safe it was. Its potential for abuse was limited. Anytime people started raising these concerns, they pushed back. We don't need to have prior authorization by doctors on this drug to restrict its use. You had this moment in the 2000s when in West Virginia, there's a state – the state health insurance provider started noticing that a lot of state employees were dying early, and on the cause of death for many of them was oxycodone. Mm-hmm. And so they noticed this, and they tried to do something about it. And there was – the company blocked the state's attempts to protect its own workers and tried to block regulation of the drug. So eventually the company paid a – you know, what was at the time a record fine for – you know, defrauding, misleading people, like admitted to committing crimes in underplaying the danger of the drug and how they marketed it. However, and the reason we're talking about this is the Sackler family, which made billions of dollars because of this, most of its money from this drug, at the same time were very generous philanthropists.
Yeah.
The Sackler Galleries. I mean, this city probably has some. New York is full of Sackler things. The Washington Sackler Gallery of Art. Sackler art stuff is everywhere. You know, universities have Sackler centers, this and that. And so they were, you know, on this spree of and by the way, when I was growing up, you know, and coming of age, a lot of this drug stuff was going on. But I didn't know about any of it and associate it with them. I knew a lot about – I'd heard the Sackler name – only in connection with all their generosity. The problem is, and there are several, that you know they made billions selling that drug, and they've given away, frankly, much less. Mm-hmm. They cause social problems that you know obviously giving to art museums are never going to solve. I mean, I think the you know not all from that drug, but now there's an estimate that 200,000 people have died in America from these related overdoses and other complications. I mean. Those are genocide Shocking. Numbers, right? Yeah. That's an extraordinary number of people to have died from the same kind of thing. And one of the core arguments of the book is generosity has been allowed to masquerade as justice in our society. We don't think about what does it mean to bring justice to the people behind something like that. We kind of let them sprinkle little gifts on our society, and we kind of forgive people, and we essentially let them buy mercy on the cheap.
Let me read some more comments. One from Margot, who tweets, totally agree. Look at how many foundations give for policy, but neglect connecting people to the issue that demands that policy, i.e. clean water, national ocean policy. The outreach was never done for the people, just to the electeds. Stu writes, the guest has it right, but how do we unbrainwash the citizens on a large scale? Is that the solution, to unbrainwash people?
Well, you know, I mean, just on the first one, like one number that I've always found so striking. The New York Times reported this a few years ago, and it was in the Journal of Preventative Medicine. Coca-Cola and Pepsi, between 2011 and 2015, donated charitably to 95 health institutions that were fighting obesity and things like that. In that same period, they lobbied against 29 bills actually trying to solve that problem publicly. So the so the commenter is absolutely right that there's this often double game of supporting a cause while you're actually trying to lobby against the public solving its own problems. In terms of the brainwashing thing, look, I wrote this book as an attempt at helping to unbrainwash people. So if there's people you think are brainwashed in your lives on this score, like, buy them the book. But you know, I think the idea is we have been told a story, and stories are very powerful. And the story we've been told is that people don't really make change anymore. It's rich and powerful people who make change. They're the one changing the world. Zuckerberg's changing the world. Elon Musk is changing the world. These philanthropists are changing the world. Donald Trump is changing the world. Well, I wrote the book to try to convince people and show people the lie of that. Because I think once you can actually see past that lie, we can get over this false notion that it requires permission slips from the powerful to make change. And it is possible, as I say, at the city level, at the state level, and at the federal level, as an activist, as an insider running for office, fighting cases in court. There's a lot of ways to make change that is public, democratic, universal, institutional. And I would just urge your listeners, next time you see something in your society you don't like, look for a solution that would solve it at the root for everybody, not a private gilded fix.
Alexis has a great question, but unfortunately we don't have time for it. But it's one that was on my mind as well. Alexis from Allentown saying about the Nike Kaepernick commercial that is now out. Genuine market ploy, conscious, subconscious level. How do you see that? And the idea, obviously, is Nike using Kaepernick, who has been persona non grata for a lot of people, as really the face, the voice of their brand.
Well, at one level, I think it's great that they attach themselves to a man who is truly courageous and truly a hero, in my view, and a man of real courage and willing to sacrifice everything for what he believes. However, my concern is that a lot of these companies, when they attach themselves to these social justice causes, they don't actually change anything about themselves deeply. They just attach themselves to the cause. What would be more powerful is if they actually were interested in having Kaepernick's spirit and values infuse Nike and actually change how they do their production, change how
they make
their hiring
shoes,
practices, you know, how much they pay people, et cetera. Because on the issue of how much they pay people, on the issue of production, on the issue of sexual harassment, the big problem they have with sexual harassment, Nike has not always been a company that embodies values anywhere near Kaepernick's values. So what I would say about Nike is, you know, don't just profit off him taking the knee. It would be great if Nike actually sat and learned at his knee, learned from him how to be more like him.
I'm going to end on that note. Anand Giridharadas, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, his book is called Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He is a writer. In fact, his other books include The True American and India Calling. And he is also a political analyst for MSNBC, teaches journalism at New York University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and you can sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Sturm, with help today from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.